and see, Tony, whether you can give us a bit of a heads up on what's been going on in South Australia. And is this latest event related to their previous ones?
Oh, Roderick, good morning.
Good morning.
in some ways, there is a relationship in that, you know, violent storm weather, which Australia has always been a hostage to from time to time, will cause damage to infrastructure, and in particular, you know, power infrastructure and the wires and poles that get the electricity to our homes and businesses is subject to that. Mm. And so we've seen, you know, those sort of events. I live in Melbourne, and Melbourne over the pre-Christmas period, not sort of the whole state, but certainly some parts of Victoria were without power when we had major storm disruption, and we've seen that around the place. So that element of all this is just par for the course, I guess, and until we ever decide we're going to put all of our power lines underground, that will be the nature of the beast.
Sort of disruption did you have in Melbourne?
Well, we had a situation where some suburbs were without power for some hours when power lines were taken down by storms, so you get violent, you know, strong winds. In South Australia in particular, they had in late September, they had a very, very violent set of storms with almost mini tornadoes in the middle of them, and that, you know, did dramatic damage to major transformation. Basically, they're very large, the major power lines, the transmission lines that bring the power across the state, and they're the ones that really cause the damage. I mean, bringing down power lines around the suburbs is obviously disruptive and potentially unsafe, but that can be usually fixed up pretty quickly. But in Victoria, we saw some of those where some suburbs were without power, but power was restored generally pretty quickly. In South Australia, where those big transmission line towers were brought down because of violent storms, we saw a much greater impact. And that, together with some other unusual characteristics of what we now have in South Australia, did bring the whole state to a situation where the whole state was blacked out, which was obviously far more serious. And that resulted in, you know, action being taken both by the state government and more particularly by the federal government to undertake a major review of the security of the electricity system driven by those events in South Australia.
Because I suppose what people, when they start talking about energy policy and electricity and so forth, really what's happened is we've got a kind of a market system going in Australia where this is determining on whether, various power stations start up or put down, or whether one state helps another state and that sort of thing. Could you perhaps give us a bit of a rundown on how that's working at the moment?
Well, broadly speaking, for the last 100 years, electricity, as it's been growing and as our economy's grown, has been pretty much provided on a state-by-state level, depending on what's the best available resource. So, you know, coal in Queensland and New South Wales, brown coal in Victoria, hydro in Tasmania and so forth, and a lot of gas in South Australia, and with a bit of transmission interconnection. Now, as we've also now recognised the need to deal with climate change, we have a problem where our response to climate change and the need to maintain the affordability and the security of our electricity system are in some degree of conflict. And getting that balance right is a big challenge for policymakers. So in South Australia, you know, we had a very large increase in renewable energy driven by government policy, and that resulted in something like 40% of South Australia's electricity being generated by wind. Now, if you're an environmentalist, obviously you think that's a fantastic outcome. And in terms of reducing emissions, it certainly is. But what it also did, because you've got all this extra power coming into a system, inevitably that puts financial pressure on the existing generators. They go out of business, in particular coal. Again, environmentalists would say, well, that's a great outcome. But what we also haven't dealt with is the fact that the wind power is intermittent, namely that there are times when the wind isn't producing its full output. In fact, there have been times when it produces almost nothing just because of the weather. It's not an anti-wind statement, it's just a statement of fact.
Yeah. So I'm like, for instance, you know, a very high wind, it can be too high for the wind generators, and they have to actually stop generating power, don't they?
Indeed. And the same, you know, with solar, the same issue applies. Obviously, solar power isn't generating when the sun isn't shining. And so how do you deal with that? And one of the ways you deal with that is you depend upon interconnection from other states. So obviously that doesn't work for solar. But for wind, if the wind isn't blowing in South Australia, you could become more dependent upon being able to import electricity from Victoria. Now, that's fantastic, provided the interconnector between South Australia and Victoria is up and running at full capacity. And we've had situations where that also wasn't the case. And the combination of those circumstances, very low very low wind output in a state where we become more dependent upon wind and dependent upon the interconnector, this creates a real problem. And then you get a violent storm like we had, and you end up with the statewide blackout that we saw. So, you know, that, as I said, that resulted in some very clear action by government. There's no simple solutions. I don't think we're not as though we're faced with the certainty of power blackouts, but it just means that we've got a system which is far more susceptible to these sort of disruptions, and that means we've got to rapidly address these issues. And that's why the government appointed the COAG Energy Council, appointed Alan Finkel, the chief scientist, to undertake a review of the system, because we clearly need to get on top of it.
Mm. And what happened also in South Australia? There was big prior to that event. There was big peaks in the price for electricity, wasn't there? Which affected the way the distribution was being supplied.
Well, the inevitable result is that, you know, if wind and solar were cheaper than coal, we'd have done it already, right? The fact that they're not means we do require government policy and government support to ensure that we can transition to low emission energy technologies. And when you get that circumstances in which you're going from a situation of, you know, very low, overwhelmingly electricity system supplied by very cheap coal and gas, and you move towards more expensive wind and solar, prices are going to go up. And that's just an inevitable consequence of the transition we have to undertake. And we need to be very clear, I think, that that's what's going to be the outcome. We don't want to do it overnight, and we obviously have to be cognizant of the consequences of dealing with the potential price increase. But we can't pretend it's not going to happen, and we also can't pretend that climate change is going to go away either. So you've got to deal with both of these issues at the same time. In the middle of all that, you end up with a situation where gas in Australia has also become more expensive than it used to be for a range of other reasons. And so when we had a situation in South Australia back in July of last year, we saw some very high price increases when gas was the only alternative, and there wasn't, and the gas-fired power stations had actually been mothballed, and so there was a lot of scrambling to try and fix that. And the role of gas is probably one of the more complicating issues as well.
Because, I mean, there's the cost of generation. There's also the cost of transmission, because we've got the longest, I think, network in the world from Port Douglas all the way down to Ceduna in South Australia, that's all connected. Distribution, and then there's retail. And what sort of percentage of cost are all those sort of four areas being coming to the consumer? Like if you're looking at your bill, how much is all that sort of proportioning out to?
The thing that consumers across Australia have seen driving electricity prices over the last 5 or 6 years have been in the network prices, that is the transmission and distribution systems. And we've seen increases over the last 5 or 6 years of over 50% in real terms. And that's obviously been a real problem for consumers, both domestic and households. Domestic and businesses. So that's about 40% of your end bill. About another, depending on what size consumer you are, whether you're a business consumer or a household, the actual cost of the energy, that is the electricity or the gas, might be another 40% or so, and then the retail is the last 10 to 20%. And you also get in there some of the cost of the some climate policies, like the renewable energy target, adds a little bit to the price of electricity. So we've seen network prices go up a lot. They've sort of stabilised now for a while, but we're now seeing, for the reasons we were just talking about, Roderick, some increases in the wholesale price. That is the mixture of energy moving away of electricity in particular, moving away from what has been very cheap, coal and gas, towards either more expensive gas, or in particular, more expensive wind and solar, and then dealing with intermittency. Inevitably, that means the wholesale component, which has been maybe 30-40%, is now going to be the main driver of price increases into the future.
Yeah, because, the cheapest electricity was from stations like Hazelwood, wasn't it? The brown coal, because the brown coal is right next to the station, so you don't have to transport it very far. And the other, then it moves up to various black coal and so forth. And I think wind is really quite a good deal more expensive, isn't it, per kilowatt hour or whatever. And of course, solar, again, is higher again. So you have to sort of look at the economic cost of that and what people are going to be willing to pay and what industry can afford to pay, I suppose, in some cases, before you can sort of, you have to factor that into the equation, don't you? Even though people are, of course, wanting to go to renewable energy because it's obviously sounds much better for the environment and much better for the future. But it's a pretty big balancing act, isn't it?
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, you can't of the three major issues we need to grapple with, and the federal minister Josh Frydenberg has made this point in relation to the three major elements of affordability, reliability, and low emissions. If you go after any one of those, the other two will suffer. So you've got it's a very delicate balancing act. And I think the real challenge as we now grapple with these issues is to be clear that we will get a balance of all three, but it will be a balance, and that means that none of them will be perfect. We won't get the perfect environmental outcome. We won't get the perfect cost outcome, and we want to make sure that we maintain a highly reliable system. And so, that's the challenge as we grapple with what is now, I think, recognised as an inevitable and necessary transition away from fossil fuels, because we haven't been paying the environmental cost of climate change, and now we have to. And as we meet that cost, we need to deal with with this interesting challenge.
And like with the closure of Hazelwood, Victoria is becoming less dependent on fossil fuels. But what with the reliability aspect, you've got two pretty key states with New South Wales and Victoria, really. That's sort of the main game in many ways.
Right.
What happens if either of those two, if there's a problem with either of those two power generation systems? Can either one of those, how is that contingency being looked at for the future?
At the moment, we're in a reasonably good position. I mean, because electricity demand hasn't been growing, in fact, it's had been falling, with the exception of Queensland, where LNG exports have done other things. We've seen a situation where we've had oversupply of power generation capacity as all the existing coal-fired power stations were in place, and we added all that renewable energy we've already spoken about, which on current numbers would be about 23% of our electricity by 2020. So, that means we're in a pretty good position from a supply perspective.
So does that meet our Paris obligations?
No, we need that's going to be, and that's the other challenge, right? So you've got a very highly reliable system in a broad sense, although the South Australians might not agree with that broad statement. But you've now got to deal with the reality of dealing with climate change, and that means that dependency on those large coal-fired power stations will have to change. And we now recognise, as a result of what happened in South Australia, that as we make a transition, we can't just say, okay, we're going to go from coal to wind and solar, as simply as that. We're going to have to deal with how do we grapple with the intermittency challenge, which means looking at issues to do with storage, looking at issues to do with the use of gas to meet intermittent peak demand, and interstate transmission in some cases as well, recognising that, if it's all very well for South Australia to import brown coal-fired power from Victoria, but if Victoria itself is moving away from brown coal-fired power, then, of course, that interdependency becomes more challenging. And so what we are recognising, I think the COAG Energy Council has recognised, that we have an interdependent system much more than we've ever had before. And that means that it's critically important that the state governments, state and territory governments, work very closely with the federal government to ensure that we have a coordinated approach to this. It doesn't make any sense for individual states or territories to go off doing their own thing, even though they might be well-intended. If it means that you end up stuffing up the system because, states like Victoria, for example, are physically connected to South Australia, Tasmania and New South Wales. And so what happens in one state affects the others.
Yeah. And if two states need help at the same time, it could prove to be a bit of a complicating factor, couldn't it?
And that's why things are getting more complicated, and that's why we need to be very, I think 2017 will be a very important year in terms of both energy policy and climate policy.
Yeah. And even Queensland, really. I mean, Victoria could supply Queensland electricity via New South Wales, couldn't they?
Yes, indeed.
Well, we do have it's all interconnected. Apart from Western Australia, who are out in their own, they've got to look after their own backyard.
Indeed. There's a lot of interconnection, but of course, we've never really thought about being so dependent upon that interconnection as we are now. And there'll be a more focus on even increasing the interconnection in coming years.
Yeah. All right. Look, well, thank you very much, Tony, for giving us all that information on what's been going on with our energy markets. And appreciate you being on The Daily.
Okay. Thanks.